Hey guys, it's Ellie, and this is Classic Mysteries. And today we are continuing the tale of Boston Blackie. And actually, I'm very excited for this episode because last week we heard that gold sat on a ship, and it was relatively unguarded on that steamer for 3 weeks, and Boston Blackie was like, all right, I'm going to steal it. So we boarded the same ship that the gold was on, and something happened. Like, two other criminals that were on board were arrested when they got to port, but no stolen gold was found, and Boston Blackie wasn't arrested or anything, but I'm 100% sure that he did steal gold, so I think today is going to be, like, the reveal episode where we figure out how Boston Blackie pulled it off and what went on behind the scenes, because we really didn't see any of what Boston Blackie did. The whole last chapter was from Mary's perspective, so we only saw what she saw. So anyway, that's why I'm very excited for this. So again, this is part of a series, so if you haven't listened to, at the very least, the last episode, then go ahead and listen to that, because this is gonna need some context. So, with no more waffle, let's get started. English Bill Tatman, once Sir Arthur Cumberland, looked on with grim humor and a running fire of comment as the boxes were unpacked, one by one, in the sanctuary of the First National's gold room. "Look at it, Scotty," he said to his morose pal, sorry about the accent, with a wave of his hand toward the steadily growing pile of gold bars. "There's enough tin to make honest churchmen of us, and bobbies too. Deuce lucky, however, that we didn't have any of the stuff in our luggage." That's more Scottish than British. What am I even doing? I'm sorry. As the easy-tempered prisoner rambled on with his monologue, the bank messengers threw back the lid of another chest. As it opened, they uttered a cry of dismay. Inside, replacing the gold that should have been there, was a neat pile of bars, half of them pig iron, half of them lead. See, I told you, Boston Blackie did steal gold. Yes! He just did it so expertly that nobody noticed. And somehow he got past the sealed chests because these frickin' 2-foot-long honkers of gold bars were just sitting in sealed chests, like 30 of them, I think. And he managed to take out the real gold and put in fake gold and then seal the chest back up, all while getting into a vault that has two keys that the two people that have the keys keep them on their person all the time. Like, I cannot wait to see how Boston Blackie pulled this off. Before dawn, flaring newspaper extras told the city of Seattle that $60,000 in gold bars had been stolen from the strongroom of the Humboldt, and that though two known crooks had been taken at the dock and were safely locked in cells, the missing gold inexplicably had been spirited ashore and safely away, although every piece of luggage on the ship was searched inside and out. Okay, how do you transport 2-foot-long gold bars effectively? Like, there is no way. Maybe he just, like, chucked it off the side of the ship and then dove down later and took it. I don't know. He must have gotten it out of the ship before they checked all the luggage, which means he could have just chucked it down to the seafloor and then dived for it later. But I doubt that, because they would have to be really far out, because from what we hear, this is a pretty big ship, you know? So they wouldn't be, like, you know, right up against the shore. Anyway. As the enthusiastic police reporters informed their city editors, the story was turning out to be, quote, a whale of a mystery yarn. While the gloomy conference at the bank was still in progress, Boston Blackie's Mary admitted herself to a modest bungalow in the outskirts of the city. Within was the white-haired, motherly woman, who, with her four daughters, had been passengers on the Humboldt from Victoria. "All here?" Mary inquired eagerly. "All but Blackie and Luz," answered the woman. "There was no rumble at the dock, was there?" "None. Blackie was through the gate and safely away before I left." Did they have it so that this family took out gold for them? "It was a wonderful job, wonderfully pulled," asserted Mary, relaxing from the long strain. "Blackie should be here any minute now. Then we only have to put the gold in a safe place and drop out of sight for a while. You have given up this house regularly without risking suspicion?" "I arranged it all yesterday before we left for Victoria, and exactly as Blackie directed me," the woman returned. "The rental agent knows I'm moving in the morning. The girls are gone already. They caught the night train further south." The doorbell rang. "That's Blackie now," cried Mary, rushing to the door. She flung it open unhesitatingly, an eager, welcoming smile on her face. Then as she glimpsed the form outside, she stepped quickly forward and barred the entrance. On the doorstep stood Miss Nina Francisco.
What?
Oh, man. She must have had a part to play in this. She wasn't working with Blackie, I don't think, because, you know, we heard some of her thoughts in the last episode. So I don't think she's working with Blackie, although she could be, but I doubt it. So, like, why is she here? How did she know where to go? Did she follow Mary? Because that would be likely, because she knows that Mary was up to something. Although I do not know what. So maybe she took the initiative to follow Mary after she got off the boat. Maybe.
You! Cried Mary, startled beyond further speech. Miss Whitney! Ejaculated the woman, equally amazed.
Then she began to laugh, but with a strained, false note in her merriment.
How stupid of me not to have guessed who you really are during all those days we spent together on shipboard, she said with a shake of her dark head. Why are you here? Where did you get this address? Demanded Mary.
Nina drew a slip of paper from her pocket and handed it to her frankly suspicious friend. On it was written, in Blackie's well-known hand, the street number, with these words added, immediately upon landing.
Come in, invited Mary reluctantly.
I don't understand all this, but Blackie's note seems to make it all right. Who are you, Miss Francisco? Have we ever met?
Never, said the visitor with an elusive half-smile. I never saw you before I boarded the Humboldt, though you must have seen a letter I once wrote, I believe.
A letter written long ago, Mary Dawson, when your Blackie was risking his life to save a pal from death on the scaffold at Folsom Prison, California. Do you remember that letter?
It was signed by a woman called Rita, and it told how she had done for Boston Blackie's sake the one thing he couldn't do himself for his pal because Fred the Count betrayed him. Do you remember now? Yes, I remember! Ugh!
Oh my gosh, if you listen to that episode, you know that I totally hate Rita. But that's only because she wouldn't back off flirting with Blackie. Oh, it was Rita the whole time. I actually had a sneaking suspicion at the very beginning, but I was like, dude, that's stupid. You know, there can be more than one female character in a book. But no, I was right. It's Rita.
At least we saw her reasonable side. At least we saw her, like, clever side. And she wasn't just trying to flirt with Blackie the whole time. Like, she was actually smart. She was, you know, suspicious of Mary, which is fair. But yeah.
If she did know who Mary was, though, that would have definitely caused problems. Because she's kind of bitter at Mary for getting Blackie. So, oh my goodness. Imagine the drama if she knew what was going on the whole time and she knew that Blackie and Mary were on board. Oh my gosh. Well, Rita, I guess you kind of redeemed yourself a little bit. You're still, you know, annoying for having flirted with Blackie for that one entire episode, but I mean, hopefully you've mended your ways and you've decided to back off. But oh my gosh, what a twist, right?
Rita! Cried Mary. The woman who saved the Cushions kid! The woman who...
She stopped, a quick flush dyeing her face.
Yes, continued Rita, taking up the interrupted sentence and meeting Mary's eyes with a level, unflinching gaze. The woman who isn't ashamed to admit she would give everything in this world for what she knows you have and will never lose. Boston Blackie's love.
Oh my gosh. Get a life, lady.
Another ring at the doorbell ended an awkward silence. Mary recognized Luz and Blackie in the two forms on the step. As she opened the door, Blackie caught her in his arms and held her to his breast.
We've won, little sweetheart, he cried joyously. All here and everything okay, little girl?
As Mary nodded, he caught sight of the visitor within. Rita! He exclaimed. You lost no time in finding the house, which is well, for we're leaving before dawn.
He dropped into a chair and began to laugh.
Share the joke, demanded Mary.
I can't help laughing, he cried. When I think of the paper you wasted warning me against Miss Nina Francisco, detective, while Miss Francisco was equally busy writing notes warning me against the dangerous machinations of Miss Marie Whitney, also a detective, it was better than a farce.
So they were both reporting to Blackie about the other, and neither knew who the other was. Okay, that's actually really funny. Oh, man. I'm telling you, this would make into a great movie.
I saw you the night I boarded the Humboldt at Nome, and when I saw parts of that note Mary wrote, with wireless treasure room and detectives so suggestively appearing in it,
I suspected her, for the ship's people had managed to let everyone know there were detectives aboard. I knew you wouldn't travel to Alaska for your health. I knew we carried a fortune in gold in the strong room. And putting two and two, I guessed it was you they planned to trap, the girl explained. But I was a fool not to know you could and would protect yourself.
Never, Blackie denied promptly. You proved yourself true blue, particularly when you risked everything to knock that revolver from Cumberland's hand. You did do it, didn't you?
Yes, said Nina, without enthusiasm.
And Mary was just behind, ready to knock my gun from my hand if I hadn't attacked the right man.
Rita, said Blackie seriously, we owe you something for that timely blow. It entitles you to a bit with the rest of us. You've earned a share of the gold. The woman shook her head. Not me, Blackie, she said soberly. I don't want money from you. Her mood changed with the words, and she smiled up at him.
There's something I do want, Blackie, she said. I want to know how it was all done, if you'll trust me.
Trust you? Of course I do, Blackie assured her. You're one of us since that night in Sacramento when you saved my pal from the rope. How did we do it? Rita, it's as simple as taking eggs from a hen's nest. Mary's was the only difficult part, getting the wax impressions of the two keys. I led the purser on to show me the strong room on the northbound trip while it was empty, and there was no reason why anyone mightn't be admitted, said Mary in response to Blackie's nod to begin. I pretended to be amazed that his two tiny keys could protect such a vast treasure as he said the Humboldt would carry back from Nome. I picked them up as they lay in his hand, and, accidentally of course, dropped one. As I fumbled about my feet for it, I took impressions of both keys on a circlet of locksmith's wax, which was ready on my wrist. Ah, so that circlet that she gave Blackie at the beginning of last episode was actually the keys to the vault, basically. So, nice. Or at least one of the keys to the vault.
Of course, said Rita.
Then, turning to Blackie, but how did you get the gold out of the strong room? How did you get it ashore?
All much simpler than getting the keys, Blackie said. On the night of the battle outside the strong room, I had been inside with the treasure since the previous night. Luz let me in and locked the door behind me. He had just removed the padlock to release me when the Englishman appeared to try his luck at the game. His idea evidently must have been to saw or burn off the original padlock and substitute the duplicate for which he had keys. He could then have entered the treasure room and removed the gold when he pleased.
That's not a bad idea, but wouldn't burning it or sawing it set off the alarm? Because it is wired with an alarm, so that probably would have tripped it, so.
Luz jumped him and, with your help, put him out. Meanwhile, I slipped back to my stateroom.
But the gold? Surely you couldn't have carried it with you. And besides, they searched all the cabins immediately and found nothing.
They didn't find gold outside the strong room because there wasn't any outside. It was still in the strong room, and there it stayed until the Humboldt was docking.
I can't guess the answer to that, said Rita.
No. Well, perhaps you remember that my little pal Mary was on the steamer, and being a woman, naturally she had trunks with her. One of those trunks was turned over to the purser for safekeeping. So, having been stored in the strong room, it was inside with me and the gold during the 24 hours I spent there. Beastly dull 24 hours too, for it didn't take but one to empty a chest, transfer the gold bars to Mary's trunk, and substitute in the chest the iron and lead bars that had been in her trunk. Then I replaced the broken seal with a duplicate Luz made in Nome as soon as he saw the kind used on the treasure chests.
So all the time they were hunting the ship for gold, but it was still in the strong room, but in Mary's trunk, cried Rita with rapt appreciation.
That's worthy even of you, Blackie, but how did you get it ashore? They searched Mary's trunk with all the rest.
Certainly, but they found nothing because the gold was no longer in Mary's trunk when it reached the custom house men, Blackie said. Tell her, Mary.
Do you remember the girls I met on the ship after we left Victoria?
My old school friends, you know, to whom I introduce you, began Mary.
Well, those young ladies didn't carry any baggage except ordinary one-night traveling bags, but when they came off the Humboldt, each of them, including their nice white-haired mother, had one of these contrivances strapped around her waist under her clothes. Mary opened a closet and dragged from the floor a canvas belt in which, bent to fit snugly against a woman's body, was one of the missing gold bars for which the Seattle police were combing the city.
I bent them to the proper shape when I was in the strong room, reproaching myself that I could only allow myself 150 pounds from the tons of old Clancy's gold that lay there, mine for the taking, said Blackie. That's the whole story, Rita, except that when I got Mary's warning that a woman in Seattle had tipped off our game to the coppers, I knew that we hadn't been tipped off for no one, not even good old Mother Archer or the four girls with her, knew what was wanted of them or what we planned to do until Mary told them today on the Humboldt. Therefore, I naturally concluded that there must be another mob on board the Humboldt on the same errand as ourselves, and that when we reached the dock at Seattle, the detectives would be waiting for them, not us. And so it turned out. Now you know it all, Rita.
He rose and beckoned to Luz.
We've work to do, he said. This stuff has to be taken to the safe place I prepared for it. Immediately, too, for it never pays to take unnecessary chances. You better do as I suggest and take a share of the stuff for yourself, Rita.
No, Blackie, nothing for me.
Goodbye, then, and good luck,
he answered, as he and Luz staggered out, each laden with belts of gold. As the men disappeared, Mary and Rita eyed each other throughout a silence palpably heavy with thoughts neither cared to utter.
I'm going now, said Rita finally, rising and moving quickly toward the door.
Mary made no comment or protest.
As she stood in the doorway, Rita turned and laid both hands on Mary's shoulders.
Goodbye, dear, she said gently. If you were not Boston Blackie's Mary, and I were not Rita, a woman who would give her soul to have his love, we could be good pals. But as it is, I imagine the only word we may say to each other in friendship is goodbye.
Goodbye, Rita, said Mary, and watched her guest pass swiftly into the street and vanish in the darkness.
Mary locked the door and began to make coffee for Blackie.
Cool.
Gosh, that's so awkward. Like, they could have been friends if Rita wasn't so set on having Blackie's heart and soul. Like, honestly, just, you know, get over him and you could have a sweet friend, but no, you're just obsessed with her husband.
Chapter 16. The Frame-Up. The robbery of the SS Humboldt grew to be a very nasty thorn in the tender side of the Seattle police. Larry Rentor, chief of detectives, slammed up his phone, chewed the end from the unlighted cigar between his clenched teeth, and banged a heavy, hairy fist upon his desk in savage exasperation.
"Wants his gold bars back or my job, does he?" Rentor growled angrily. "It's safe to trust old Jim Clancy to want somebody's scalp if anything happens to singe his hide. Does the doddering idiot think a crook smart enough to make $60,000 in gold vanish at sea from a steamer's double-locked strongroom is likely to leave it lying around where my bunch of half-witted four-flushers can find it?" Chief Renter spat out the mutilated remnant of his cigar and eyed his phone speculatively and with growing gravity. Over it, but a moment before, he had been told by James J. Clancy, aged and irascible president of the Northwestern Steamship Company, that unless the Humboldt's mysteriously missing gold was recovered, the resultant police shakeup would jar loose the gold star at present glittering on the breast of Rentor's uniform. The hairy chief knew that Clancy had both the will and the political prestige to uphold his threat. "It's up to me to get busy or out, and I'll not get out. Not if I can help it," the chief said to the empty room. "I'll get the gold if I can. If I can't, I'll find a goat and tie this caper to him."
Then, being a shrewd and politic detective, well aware of the undeniable advantage of favorable publicity, Larry Rentor pressed a button and told his secretary to admit the newspapermen awaiting impatiently in the outer office. To these, he dictated an interview brimming with assurance, in which he hinted a solution of the mystery was at hand, predicted the early arrest of the Humboldt robber gang, and promised the recovery of the loot, quote, within a few hours. With the reporters satisfied and out of his way for the moment, the chief seized a fresh cigar, sagged down in his chair, and concentrated the full power of his, by no means mediocre, mentality on the problem that confronted him.
Oh, fun. This guy is gonna be a fun character. Wow.
3 unbroken days and nights of unmitigated third-degree harrying had developed nothing more satisfactory than increasingly vehement denials of guilt from Tatman and his partner, and Chief Rentor, shrewd in judging men of their type, at last was forced to the conclusion that they spoke the truth. Who, then, had stolen the gold?
"If Tatman is innocent, as I know he is," Rentor said to himself, "the man I want is the one who struck him down outside the strongroom door. No one on the shipboard, passenger, officer, or seaman, admits giving the blow.
That proves it wasn't struck to protect the gold. The detective's mind leaped to the logical conclusion.
One of two things is true, he decided. There was another crook mob aboard the steamer, and it, not a Tatman, got the gold. Or this business was an inside job, and the thieves are on the steamer payroll. Nothing amazing in that. Gold by the hundredweight will tempt anything human.
I mean, he's right.
Had Rentor guessed that Boston Blackie and Mary, his wife and pal, were among the humbled passengers, his summing up of the possibilities would have ended with the first alternative. From the standpoint of a man unaware of this all-important fact, however, Rentor's second theory was far from implausible. The unbroken but open padlock found near the door of the looted treasure room, and the fact that the missing gold was not found when the steamer was searched immediately after the robbery, or in the baggage of any of the passengers, strengthened the thought growing in Rentor's mind that the vanished fortune might still be hidden on shipboard. Gold bars 2 feet long and weighing 30 pounds each are not easily hidden within a passenger's cabin.
He's right. I mean, come on, dude. Those things are massive honkers. You think you're just gonna fit those in your pant leg? I mean, they kinda did, but it wasn't their pant leg, it was their pant waist.
Rentor touched the button that summoned his secretary. McNaughton, captain of the Humboldt, is coming down shortly, he said. When he arrives, bring him in at once and admit no one else till I ring.
As he waited, the gossamer clues upon which he must work expanded in the brain of the detective.
The strongroom lock was opened by keys made for it, he mused. The purser had one, the captain the other, and there were no duplicates. That's a fact that means something.
The door opened to admit the big, bluff, white-bearded commander of the Humboldt.
What progress, Chief? Asked McNaughton anxiously.
Rentor studied the face of the visitor silently.
Considerable, Captain, he said slowly. More than you would imagine possible. What would you say if I told you I know the Humboldt was robbed by men paid to protect her treasure, by men on the ship's payroll?
Rentor watched the effect of his question with keen eyes half concealed by drooping lids. McNaughton, startled by the suggestion, met the chief's gaze squarely.
Impossible, he said at last. No member of the crew had an opportunity, and all my officers, well, sir, I know them all. There's not a thief among them.
Rentor leaned across the table and tapped its top.
And yet, he said, the padlock was removed intact from your strongroom door by two keys that fitted it. The most expert locksmith in America couldn't have made duplicate keys without the originals as models. That means one of two things. Either the original keys were used to open the treasure room door, or as patterns for the duplicates that did open it. Which was it, McNaughton? You and the purser are the two men who had the keys in your keeping.
McNaughton leaped to his feet, his face purple with rage.
Do you dare to accuse me of robbing my own steamer, sir? He cried, shaking a weather-bronzed fist at the detective. I don't accuse anybody, yet, Rentor answered quietly. But I have just stated a fact you can't deny. And, Captain, every man, woman, and child who was on the Humboldt is under suspicion till this mystery is cleared. Sit down and we'll get to brass tacks. You have told me that you and the purser together locked the door of the vault immediately after the gold was placed there at Nome, and that your key never left the belt you wear around your waist night and day. Are you absolutely sure that's the truth?
Absolutely.
Your key was never out of your possession for an instant. No passenger or officer went to you with a story of something to be put in or taken out of the strongroom? Think carefully, Captain, and remember your reputation is at stake in this matter.
The key never left my body, McNaughton answered without hesitation. No one asked to have the strongroom door opened for any purpose whatsoever, and I wouldn't have permitted it if I had been asked. It is specially prohibited by the company that the treasure room be opened at sea when we're carrying the Nome gold, and I obey orders. No, Rentor, from the moment I locked up the bullion, the key never left my belt. The captain sat a moment, thinking. On the northbound trip, when the strongroom was empty, he began, then paused, suddenly hesitant.
Yes, yes, on the northbound trip when the strongroom was empty. What happened then? Demanded Rentor eagerly.
I remember now that Purser Jessen came to me and asked for my key. He wanted to show our treasure room to some curious passenger, the captain replied with reluctance. But that means nothing. We could have left the strongroom door open if we had chosen. There was nothing inside, then, to be stolen. Rentor bent over his desk and hid the eager, praying light in his eyes as he fumbled for another cigar.
"How long did this Mr. Jessen have both the keys?" he demanded with the exultant ring of unhoped-for triumph in his voice.
"A half hour, possibly an hour. I didn't notice particularly." The captain now was grave and plainly worried.
"Don't jump to conclusions because of what I've told you, Chief. I know Jessen. I knew his father, the old captain, and a finer, straighter man never walked a ship's bridge. I've known young Dave since the days when I dandled him on my knee when he wore short breeches. I've seen him grow up and become a ship's officer in line for a command of his own someday. He had no hand in this crooked business. No, sir. Dave Jessen's like his dad. Straight."
Rentor leaped up with a scoffing, worldly wise smile on his lips.
"Because you held this fellow on your knee when he was a boy, that's no reason he mightn't be a crook," he cried belligerently. "If his father was honest, that's no reason he is. And I'll tell you now, we'll prove he isn't. While he had your key, he did one of two things. Either he made a duplicate of it himself, or he gave it to a Confederate who did. Dave Jessen's the man who robbed or helped to rob the Humboldt, and in 24 hours, I'll have his confession."
Captain McNaughton shook his head in firm unbelief.
"Call him down and talk to him," he suggested. "If he knows anything, he'll tell you gladly. But don't do anything to ruin his prospects. Reputation is about all we seafaring men have that we can't afford to lose. If you were to hold him, even on suspicion, he'd never command a ship as long as he lives. Besides, he has a mother, old and feeble, and
it isn't my business to worry about men's mothers or reputations. I put men behind bars who belong there. This young crook is going into a cell, and in a cell he'll stay till he tells me who stole the Humboldt's gold or signs a confession that he did it himself. Where does he live?"
Captain McNaughton gave the address and went out sorrowfully with a bowed head. 10 minutes later, two detectives in a police auto were on their way to Jessen's home to take him into custody as a suspect in the bullion robbery.
Oh, poor guy. He didn't do anything. He's just the nice guy and, you know, didn't suspect a cute girl of grand theft gold.
"Maybe Jessen did this, and maybe he didn't," Chief Rentor mused as he impatiently awaited the car's return. "There's better than an even chance that he's really guilty. But whether he is or not, one thing is certain. I found a goat and a bit of incriminating evidence that will justify the pinch in the newspapers."
One after another, he pulled the knuckles of his big hands until the joints cracked like pistols. That was Larry Rentor's way of expressing extraordinary jubilance. He was planning the details of the third degree by which he hoped to extort a confession that would clear the Humboldt mystery. The door of the Jessen home was opened to the detectives by a sweet-faced little woman with snow-white hair and age-dimmed eyes.
"My son is at home, I'll call him," she said in response to the detective's query.
Dave Jessen, roused from a daydream in which he stood again on the Humboldt's deck beside a dark-eyed girl with sun-tinted cheeks and wind-blown hair, appeared behind his mother. Mrs. Jessen vanished.
"Put on your hat and coat, Jessen. The chief wants to see you," said Mulligan, spokesman of the paired officers.
"Sure, I'll be with you in a jiffy," the purser agreed, dropping the nautical book in his hand.
"Mother!" he called. "I'm going down to police headquarters, but I'll be back in time for the dinner you've been fussing over all afternoon so foolishly."
He kissed her and followed the detectives to the auto waiting at the curb.
"What's happened, boys?" he inquired as they climbed into the car. "Have you caught the bullion robber?"
"I reckon we have. Now," said one detective pointedly. He drew a pair of handcuffs from his pocket and deftly slipped them over Dave Jessen's wrists.
The first instinctive flush of anger on the purser's cheeks faded, leaving him pale beneath his sea tan.
"You're arresting me?" he gasped in bewilderment. "I'm accused of the gold robbery?"
"Looks that way. What do you think yourself?" replied the detective.
"This is ridiculous. It's an outrage," cried Jessen, straining his wrists against the steel circlets so hatefully new to them. "I know nothing of the missing gold except what I've told. I'm not a thief."
"Prisons full of men I've heard say those identical words when they were arrested," said the detective. "Save all that guff for the chief, young fellow. All I've got to say to you is that you're 3 times 7 kinds of a fool to get yourself tangled in a mess like this. A nice old mother you've got, too. It'll go hard with her when she learns what you've been up to."
But man, I didn't do it. I have neither done nor said anything to justify the faintest doubt of my honesty, cried Jessen. Who dares say I robbed the Humboldt? Who accuses me?
The detectives smiled at each other knowingly.
You'll find out soon enough, replied Mulligan's partner.
Take good advice and forget that high and mighty stuff before we get you to the chief. He has the real dope on you.
Does he, though? It's all circumstantial evidence.
Then, though, Jessen, outraged, angry, incredulous, asked a dozen fiercely insistent questions, the two officers maintained an omniscient silence until the car stopped at detective headquarters. The prisoner leaped to the sidewalk in advance of his guardians.
Take me to Chief Rentor, quick, he demanded. Somebody will suffer for this, for it won't take me 10 minutes to clear myself of whatever charge some irresponsible blunderer has made against me.
Easy, lad, easy, cautioned the first of the officers, taking him by the arm and into the building through a private entrance.
You'll see the chief all right, but don't be in a hurry. Time is one thing you'll have to spare from now on.
Fretting with rage and impatience, Jessen was taken into a private room where his name was entered in the small book, a police device, unlawful, but that is a mere detail, for holding prisoners against whom the department is not ready to make a public accusation. He was searched and relieved of papers, watch, penknife, money, and all other trinkets in his pockets. Then he was pushed into a dimly lighted steel cage, and its massive door clanged behind him. A bolt shot into its sockets. The footsteps of the departing officers died away. Many minutes, each longer than any hour Jessen had ever passed, dragged away while he paced the steel floor.
It's only a few minutes, he kept assuring himself. I'm innocent. They can't keep me in this filthy den. It isn't possible.
But the minutes dragged into hours, and no one came. Meanwhile, the arresting officers were reporting.
How'd he take it? Asked Rentor, cracking his knuckles.
Mad as a she-bear, and stands pat, he knows nothing, answered Mulligan.
Naturally he'd do that, said the chief. You can't expect a man with nerve enough to pull a stunt like this steamer robbery to cough up at the first touch of the cuffs. He'll come across, though. I'll leave him in there alone to sweat a while. Tonight we'll spring the phony identification stuff, and then I'll be ready to talk turkey to him.
Chapter 17. The Third Degree.
Oh dear. Oh gosh, Jessen, you poor baby.
Rentor thinks he's all smart for figuring it out, but no, you're just being a jerk to a nice purser.
Chief Rentor then climbed into his auto and was driven home to dine leisurely, while at Dave Jessen's bungalow, a little old woman who reminded one of a fading flower fretted nervously as she kept an overdone dinner hot for the son who didn't and couldn't come. It was early in the evening, though Jessen was sure it must be early morning, when a door opened noisily in the corridor and he heard voices nearing his cell. At last! He cried, springing eagerly to the door. Suddenly, his cell was flooded with light, though the corridor beyond remained in darkness. He waited, hot with impatience, for the welcome sound of the jailer's key in the lock. Instead, a wicket in the door was lifted, and a pair of eyes peered in from the utter darkness. There was a moment's silence, then a man's voice spoke.
That's him, it said. I could swear to him on 100 Bibles.
Good, replied Mulligan's heavy voice. We knew we had him right, but this settles it.
The wicket dropped, and the men started down the corridor.
Come back! Shouted Jessen as he realized that they did not intend to release him. Take me out of this hole! I demand to be taken to the chief!
Somebody's laugh came back through the darkness as the door at the far end of the corridor closed with a bang. 10 minutes later, the same performance was repeated, and a new voice assured the detective that it would, quote, know that fellow's face anywheres. Again, Jessen's shouts and demands remained unanswered, and the lights winked out. For the first time, though the unconsciousness of innocence buoyed his drooping spirits, a numbing horror of the inconceivable thing that had happened overwhelmed him, exactly as Chief Rentor intended. Back from dinner, Rentor cracked his knuckles noisily as his men reported the prisoner's shouts and violent demands for a hearing, following the faked identifications.
Fine, he ejaculated. That stuff always jars their nerves, whether they're innocent or guilty. He's ripe now for a friendly, heart-to-heart talk. Bring him in, boys, and see that the detective phone operator is on my line, ready to get every word that's spoken in here. I'll cut out the parts of the talk I don't need afterward.
That sympathy stuff you told us to spill about his mother seemed to hit him hard, suggested Mulligan.
That's a trump card, replied the chief. Lead in the lamb and forget the bawling out I'm going to give you, boys. I want him to think I'm a friend.
Jessen, fresh from the gloom of his cell, stumbled at the threshold as the detectives threw open the door of the chief's office. They pushed him roughly into a chair, his hands still bound by the steel cuffs, and the glare of a desk lamp full upon his face.
Who's this? Asked Rentor, looking up from a pile of reports in simulated surprise.
Not Dave Jessen, handcuffed?
Take off those bracelets, Mulligan.
They've had me locked in a dirty cell for hours, Chief, interrupted Jessen. I demanded to be brought here to you, but they only laughed.
I told you to bring Jessen here to my office, but I didn't give you permission to treat him like a common crook, roared the chief angrily at his men. I knew this boy's father before he was born, and no matter what sort of trouble he is in, he will be treated right while he's in my custody, you blockheads, or I'll know why not.
I didn't think it was safe to take any chances after those two positive identifications, Chief, said Mulligan in mock humility. And you being out for dinner, I thought...
You're paid to do as you're told, not to try to think, interrupted Rentor. Get those cuffs off his wrist and get out. I want to talk to this boy alone.
As the door closed behind the detectives, the chief motioned Jessen to draw his chair closer. His manner was grave, sorrowful, deeply sympathetic.
Dave, you're up against it hard. I'm your friend, but it's going to take every bit of influence I can swing to keep you out of stripes, he began, with the air of a man who regrets his bad news. Old Clancy wants you prosecuted to the limit. How the devil did you ever come to lose your head and get tangled in a mess of this kind?
Prosecute me, I... echoed the prisoner.
Surely you can't believe I'm guilty of the robbery on the Humboldt, Chief. On my word of honor, I'm as innocent as you. I...
Rentor interrupted by laying a friendly hand on Jessen's arm.
Don't, Dave, he cautioned kindly. It's useless to deny facts. I'm your friend, willing to go the limit for you, but you must be square with me. If there are others in this job, and you help to land them and get back the gold, I think I can save you, and I'll do it for the sake of your old mother and your dead father, God bless him. But you must tell me the whole truth. I've brought you in here alone so that no one but me will ever hear what you tell me tonight.
That's not true.
It's your one chance, boy. And for the sake of your mother, who's worrying herself into hysterics already, don't throw it away.
Chief, I'm innocent, but it is evident some blunderer has given you reason to believe I'm guilty, replied Jessen. I'll clear myself to your full satisfaction in 10 minutes if you tell me exactly on what grounds you suspect me.
Rentor drew further into the shadow of the shaded lamps and fixed his eyes on the purser's face to catch the slightest betraying change of expression. Evidence against you has been coming in for 2 days, he began. But I'll ask one question that will show why we first suspected you. He paused, then thrust his face close to Jessen's and spat out his question viciously. What did you do with the 2 keys of the treasure room while they were both in your possession?
I never had both keys, answered Jessen, unperturbed and without hesitation.
From the moment we locked the gold in at Nome, Captain McNaughton...
Wait, interrupted Rentor peremptorily.
I didn't say you had both keys after the gold was shipped. You couldn't have got them then. But on the way up to Nome, Jessen, how about that? Have you forgotten your story to the captain about showing the strongroom to a curious passenger?
You're right about that, admitted the purser slowly. I did get the captain's key while we were on the way up, but what of that? The treasure room was empty then. I borrowed the captain's key to show a strongroom to a passenger, one whom I had told of the millions of gold we would carry there on the trip home. How can you connect that with a robbery many days afterward?
Rentor was cracking his knuckles as he answered. Because while Captain McNaughton's key was in your hands, duplicates of it, and of your key as well, were made for the bullion robbers, who used the duplicates later to remove the padlock when there was something in the strong room well worth taking.
With growing exultation, Rentor saw the blood drain away from Jessen's cheeks. Instantly, he knew that his bold guess had found a vulnerable mark.
What happened to those keys while they were in your possession? He snapped. Did you let them go out of your hands, or did you yourself make duplicates?
Jessen's eyes wavered and then fell. For the first time, doubt of the ultimate outcome of this interview with the chief crept into his mind.
I made no duplicates, he said nervously. Neither key was out of my hands except for a single instant.
Oh, gosh. No, he's gonna want to defend Mary because he loves her, which is weird, but he's gonna want to defend her, so he's gonna probably take the blame in the end, which is sad because he's innocent and nice.
He paused, and Rentor leaned forward, eager for the all-important admission to follow.
While we were in the empty treasure room, Jessen continued, the person to whom I was showing it remarked that it was curious such frail bits of metal could protect such vast treasure as I described. My companion took the keys from my hand and held them for a second. One dropped. She picked it up from the floor before I could stoop and handed both to me.
A woman! Cried Rentor, springing triumphantly to his feet at Jessen's use of the feminine pronoun. I might have known there was a woman at the bottom of a job as clever as this. When she dropped the key and stooped for it, she took wax impressions of both of them, of course! That stunt's as old as the hills! Who is this woman? She's the party I want now!
Jessen's chin dropped to his chest. His strong brown hands were clenched. There was a long pause, during which the thought that he had been tricked by the girl he had learned to love on that last ill-fated voyage, the girl whose gentle no when he asked for her hand had not lessened his love, what is it with this book and people loving other people that are unattainable, and even after they reject them, they're still, you know, hooked on them? That's happened twice. If I had a nickel for every time that somebody in this book liked somebody unattainable, then I would have 2 nickels. Which isn't a lot, but it's weird that it happened twice.
The girl whose gentle no when he asked for her hand had not lessened his love, seared his brain like molten metal. Could she have been guilty of playing upon that love? Her face, sweet, kind, and innocent, rose before him, and because he loved her, denied the accusation convincingly. If he named her, she, a woman, would be subjected to the tortures he was enduring. They might put her in a cell as they had him.
Jessen straightened in his chair and met Rentor's piercing eyes squarely.
I won't tell you her name, Jessen said quietly. It wouldn't be right. I know she isn't a crook, but you won't believe that. You would do to her what you were doing to me. I won't name her. You'll go to the penitentiary if you insist in protecting this woman crook. You understand that, don't you? Asked Rentor.
If necessary, I'll go, replied Jessen wearily.
Oh, poor guy. just say, like, her name isn't even her actual name. It's an alias, so it's not a problem, all right? Calm down. Don't go in prison for a girl whom you like but cannot attain, all right? Just chill out.
If this girl's innocent, I won't harm her. If she is guilty, unless you are her accomplice, why should you be willing to do time to protect her? Rentor asked, probing the one phase of the situation that still puzzled him. Jessen's apparently quixotic determination to sacrifice himself for a casual steamer acquaintance.
I'm innocent, and you've harmed me, the purser answered. The pair studied each other eye to eye.
Chief, began Jessen at last, with a note of boyish appeal in his voice, I can understand how my refusal to name the girl who, unfortunately, has been dragged into this case may seem suspicious to a man like you, whose business makes it necessary to suspect everybody. Even so, there's a spark of humanity in you, I'm sure. For her sake and mine, I'm going to tell you everything, and then I know you'll not demand her name.
Go on, said Rentor encouragingly.
She was a passenger on the Humboldt, making the round trip to Alaska with us, Jessen continued. She was alone, and I tried to make the trip pleasant for her, first for duty's sake, and then, when I grew to know her, because I treasured every moment I could be near her. Long before we reached Nome, I knew she is the one woman I want and always shall want for my wife.
Dude, chill out. Again, with him and Rita, like, they both absolutely fell head over heels in love with this person whom they've only known for, like, a few weeks, or even just a few days. Like, is this a Disney movie?
Ah.
On the return trip, I asked her to marry me. She told me there was someone else, and... Jessen raised a hand to shield himself from the coldly piercing eyes that never wavered from his face. I'm glad she's going to be happy. That's all there is to tell, Chief. Now you'll understand why I can't let the unlucky chance that led to the incident of the keys permit me to involve her even remotely in such a case as this. No decent man could do that. I know she is not a crook. Such a girl couldn't be.
That's where you're wrong. Sorry, bud.
Just, please, name her. She is a crook. You know you're innocent. You know that the only possibility of guilt lies on her at the moment, so just suck it up, alright?
Rentor pressed the button that summoned the waiting officers.
Now I've got you just where I want you, my bucko, he exclaimed gleefully. The one thing I lacked to make my case complete was a motive that would explain why you tried to protect the woman. You have just given it to me, the oldest and best motive in the world. Will you give me the name of the she-crook?
Never, said Jessen.
Take him away, boys,
Rentor ordered as his men appeared in the doorway.
Tell Clark to take this fellow's Bertillon measurements and to mug him the first thing in the morning so I can give the afternoon papers his pictures tomorrow. This has been a neat piece of work if I did do it myself.
Jessen, as he rose to follow his guards, looked down on burly Larry Rentor, half in hatred, half in scorn.
I understand now how crooks are made, Jessen said, in a voice whose evenness failed to hide the tempests of bitter anger that shook him from head to foot.
Larry Rentor merely laughed. When Jessen had been lodged again in his cell, the chief called in four of his best men and gave his instructions for the continuation of the third degree.
Handcuff him to a chair and keep at him without a second's let-up all night, he ordered. Never let him close his eyes. Never let him rest. Keep up a perfect stream of questions and drag answers out of him any way you can. Play on his love for his mother. Pretend that we have taken over the house to search it and turned her out. Pretend that we think she herself may be implicated and that she is to be brought down here in the morning for the same kind of deal he's getting. We'll take her through one of the cells for an instant tomorrow and let him see her there. That'll fetch him. Now go to it, boys.
By the way, someone better go out and talk to the old lady. She might tell something worth knowing. The men filed out.
This guy is a pig. This is so illegal. You have no real proof. And you know that. You're not even, following a false lead. You know that this is not who did it. And now you're forcing... First of all, there have got to be laws against interrogating someone violently all night and lying to him about what is happening with his mother. That would never happen in real life, right? I mean, honestly, blatant lies, really? Second of all, you're a jerk, all right? you're just a jerk. That's all I have to say.
The men filed out.
The result was a night of horror that Dave Jessen never forgot and never recalled without a shudder.
While the stenographer was transcribing those portions of Jessen's statement in which he admitted having both strongroom keys, admitted that he had given them momentarily into the possession of a woman passenger, and in which he flatly refused to give her name, Chief Rentor analyzed the results of his night's work.
Also, statements aren't official unless they're signed by the person who said them, right?
You need to sign a statement. You don't just, record someone without their knowledge and then publish it to the newspapers. That is beyond illegal, my good sir. You are going to get arrested, hopefully, sometime, because... oh my gosh.
If Jessen was an investigative reporter, you would be absolutely gone by the time he got free. You would be beyond fired.
Chief Rentor analyzed the results of his night's work.
Jessen has told the truth from beginning to end, he decided. First, he was this unknown woman's goat, and now he is mine. It's 100-1 without takers that she made impressions of the keys during the moment he left them in her hands. She had pals aboard, and of course they turned the trick.
The chief chewed his cigar reflectively, and his thoughts brought a look of shrewd and ruthless cunning to his eyes.
It's the luckiest thing in the world that this fellow is fool enough to refuse me the girl's name, he thought. If he had not done that, he would have practically cleared himself and put me up against the problem of finding the girl. As things stand now, I've almost got enough on Jessen to make a showing in court. And if I never find the woman or the gold, he gets all the blame. Anyway, it's a safe bet now that old man Clancy will be satisfied I'm big enough for my job.
The fox-like cunning in the eyes beneath Renter's shaggy brows deepened.
If Tatman would say Jessen is the man who hid him in front of the strongroom door, it was directly opposite Jessen's own door, too, my case would look good even before a jury, he reflected. That would be the final link in the chain. I'll have a talk with him.
He ordered Tatman up from his cell.
Tatman, said Rentor when they were alone.
Purser Jessen has been booked for complicity in the bullion robbery. He took both the keys to the strongroom on the northbound voyage and admits he allowed them to go into the hands of a woman on board. He refuses to give her name. Were there any crooks on the Humboldt, either men or women, that you knew?
The ex-convict shook his head.
Okay, really? Did he not recognize Blackie? He was on the ship.
Maybe he's just, you know, not writing out Blackie because it's just the right thing to do, but still, like, if he didn't recognize Blackie, then honestly, dude.
The chief continued, "You were likely to stay inside a cell for a long time, Tadman. I'm fairly well satisfied you weren't in on this, but I can't let you go until I've cinched somebody. You understand that?"
Tatman grinned without replying. He was an old hand at the game and knew the chief's sudden consideration had an explanation.
"I've just been thinking, Tatman, that if you had caught a glimpse of the face of the man who hit you, and that man happened to be Purser Jessen, I wouldn't have any object in keeping you after you had identified him in court," continued Renter insinuatingly. "This is so illegal."
Oh my goodness, I want to about stab this person. Can we get a lawyer to look at this? Because I'm not very familiar with how police stations are supposed to work, but I'm 100% certain that they're not supposed to work like this. Gosh, I hope Rentor ends up in prison.
"It would be a mighty lucky break for you, old-timer, if you happened to be able to make that identification."
"I get you, chief," said the convict. "Lead me to him when you like. It might have been him, for all I know. And anyway, he's only a square shooter. Lead me to him, that's my answer."
"You understand I want only the truth," cautioned the detective.
Tatman grinned knowingly. "I understand," he repeated.
"Okay, but do you understand?" Because it really doesn't seem like you do.
So what did we learn today? We learned that Rita isn't all bad, although she still kind of is bad. We also learned that poor Purser Jessen is willing to frickin' go to jail for an undisclosed amount of time for a girl that he knew for, like, maybe a month and had convinced himself that he loved. And third, we learned that Larry Rentor is an absolute dirtbag and should be in prison and not Purser Jessen because he's just too nice. Oh my gosh. Well, what a reveal anyway. Like, dude. Blackie totally figured out that job well. Like, Cumberland wasn't even in on the deal. He was actually a mistake. If anything, he covered Blackie's escape from the strong room instead of stealing the gold himself. So, in a way, Cumberland helped without meaning to help. So, good job, I guess. So anyway, that was a fun episode. I really hope that Jessen doesn't stay in prison for the whole rest of the book. Because he's just so dang nice, even though he's weirdly fixated on Mary. But yeah, anyway, that was a fun episode. So if you have any book recommendations, or if you have anything you want to tell me, actually, I was thinking, I don't know the context of this time period very much. Like, all I know is that, like, World War I happened, and, you know, Prohibition happened in the 1920s and stuff like that. But, like, if you want to email me and give me more context about the books that I'm reading, I would absolutely dig that. Because I'm kind of just taking these books at face value with very little context. So if you have a little bit of extra insight, feel free to send it over, because I would love to know that. Yeah, so book recommendations and or context to classicmysteriespod@gmail.com. And also, if you're on a podcast app where you can follow, you can subscribe, you can like or comment or something, go ahead and do that, because this book is insane, and I think the entire world needs to hear it. So yeah, I also have two links in the show notes at all times. One is for PayPaling me, and the other is for becoming my patron, so if you ever want to donate to me for whatever reason, feel free to do that. So yeah, my week was amazing, and I hope you guys had an amazing week as well, and I hope that you guys will have an amazing week. And yeah, I'll see you guys next Monday. Bye.